Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC New York Public Radio, this is the Brian Lehrer Show podcast. I'm Brian Lehrer. This is just one segment of our show, but everything we do is available on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open from American Express, presenting the interactive webcast event, Making a Name for Yourself. Kate and Andy Spade and Bobby Brown discuss their leap from business to brand, created by Open from American Express. Registration at openforumonline.com.
Well, the last few weeks this summer have seen some prominent Hall of Fame inductions of African Americans in both baseball and football. In football's case, some flat-out NFL superstars known to everybody in America. In baseball's case, the induction of people from the old Negro Leagues who never got their due. But let's talk about basketball for a minute. When New York Knicks Larry Johnson referred to his fellow players as rebellious slaves during the 1999 playoffs, a lot of people took offense that he would equate basketball players with their multimillion-dollar contracts with actual human bondage. Well, at least one sports writer got his point. William Roden is a sports columnist at the New York Times. Maybe you see him a lot if you read the sports section. And he used Johnson's concept, actually a fan's comment on that concept, as the title of his new book about black athletes in America called $40 Million Slaves, The Rise, Fall, and Redemption of the Black Athlete. It's out from Crown Publishing, and Bill Roden joins me now. So happy to have you for the first time on The Brian Lehrer Show. Hi.
Right, great. It's great being here. The story I was going to tell you is that the book took 8 years to do, and every day, you know, I was listening to your show, and whatever you have authors on, I said, come on, Roden, one day, come if you finish it, you can be on the show. And so whenever I was kind of, you know, I'd hear the author say, come on, I'll pick it up. So here we are. It's really a pleasure and honor to be here.
That's great. And that's an honor for me to hear that you were listening to the show while writing this book, although it must have been very distracting to hear all those voices getting you angry about the news trying to do content.
Well, you got to fire, you know, you get fired up, and then there comes to be a point that, you know, after the show is over, let's turn it off and let's go.
So you agreed with Larry Johnson when he called his fellow players rebellious slaves?
I just thought it was just such a great, because, you know, a lot of athletes, a lot of NBA players are so in tune to what they're doing. They don't really, by definition, don't have a lot of time to synthesize and put themselves in any kind of context, you know. And for Johnson, who I knew since UNLV, for him to make that type of connection and to put himself on a plantation and as rebellious slaves, not only that, you know, because that was, a lot of people don't know that kind of history, that on the plantation, that was one of a major thing, is rebelling and running away and that kind of stuff. So for him, not only just to put himself on a plantation, but say, we're rebellious slaves, yeah. I thought was very, very a kind of subtle thing. And obviously the reaction, of course, was typical sports media, you know. What do you mean? You know, how could you make 40? And as I started doing the research and going on the plantation, there was that's what the bingo part of the book. When you get on the plantation and you saw there was this thriving culture.
You mean the real historical plantation?
No, I'm talking about the real plantation in the 18th century.
Yes.
Where there were like black athletes. There were boxers. There were runners. I mean, there were because plantation owners like to have plantation versus plantation competition. Huh. So they would, if they lived near the coast, they would have rowers. I mean, there was actually black people and crew, you know. And so there was this thriving kind of, and there were wrestlers, because even in Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa, one of the sports of Africa was wrestling. You know, in Chebe's Things Fall Apart, it opens with a scene with the cat wrestling. And so a lot of slaves who came over, you know, were wrestling.
So there were white slave owners using black Americans as athletes for the entertainment of other white slave owners.
Yeah, absolutely. And betting, in fact, the first hero of the book, first character of the book, is this guy named Tom Molyneux, who was a boxer, and his owner had bet the farm on this fight, and he asked for volunteers. And if you win, you'll get $500, you get your freedom. And so Molyneux said, you know, I'll do it. And this was like 1808. And so the question was, A, has the relationship that existed then between the white owners and their black athletes fundamentally changed until now. And
the what's your answer?
Well, the answer is large part, it hasn't. And it hasn't because although the power has potentially increased in terms of numbers and money has increased, but the recognition of power hasn't really increased. So there's no understanding right now. Wow, we've got, you know, we could buy the plantation. We can get off. We can pool our resources and buy things. And I think that's what this book is kind of prodding to do.
But what would you say to the obviously many people who would still dispute the analogy and say, look, you know, Larry Johnson or any other multimillion-dollar athlete is in such a different position. Most of them now have gone to college. They have agents. They have choices in life, maybe choices that were made possible to some degree because of their athletic ability. But they, you know, and they are negotiating these contracts as independent actors, the same as white players.
Well, yeah. Actually, Curt Flood made a great statement in 1969 when Curt Flood,
Major
St. Louis Cardinals,
player, right?
when he was fighting against Antitrust Act.
Started the whole free agent thing for Major League Baseball.
And who should be in the Hall of Fame? That's another show. But one of the things he said was we as athletes are on a plantation. And it blew a lot of the white guys away because, you know what? They said, wow, you know what? You're absolutely right. We had never seen ourselves as part of a plantation, but right, they could buy us and sell us as they want. They paid us a wage. We're all wage earners, as they are today. The wage is just more. But I think that the what Johnson was saying and what's kind of true is that the amount of money you make, any of us make, but let's say, let's just keep it there. The amount of money you make has nothing to do with your relationship to power. Because if one guy is paying if Larry Johnson's making $10 million, but there's somebody who's making 15 guys on the team, millionaires, how much is that guy making? And I stumbled onto a character in the book, Charles Stewart, who was a trainer. And this is like 1806. Charles Stewart was a trainer. He was making so much money managing his owner's stable that he had to hire an agent to handle all his money. But guess what? He was still a slave. He was traded. He was sold. I said traded. He was sold a couple times, and he was able to negotiate the terms of who he was going to be sold to.
But he was still a slave.
He was still a slave.
And talk about horse racing. You have a historical concept in the book that you call jockey syndrome. Talk about that.
Yeah, the jockey syndrome, which I think is very relevant to these guys today, is that the jockey syndrome, as a general thing, is anytime black athletes, and let's just, again, keep it to athletes, I think is larger. Historically, and I go all the way back to, you know, it's Fleetwood Walker. Historically, anytime black athletes have become prominent or powerful, there's been this knee-jerk reaction among the power system to change the rules, to undercut, to eliminate, and get rid of. And the jockeys were sort of my big metaphor because black jockeys dominated horse racing from the 17th century when there was just quarter horse racing, 18th century, 19th. Black jockeys were like the NBA. They dominated. The first Kentucky Derby, 1875, 13 of the 15 jockeys were black. So black jockeys ran it. They dominated. Isaac Murphy was making, by 1890, he was making three times as much. But what happened is that the white jockeys got jealous, the white track owners, and so what they did is that they basically conspired to run them out. The jockey club was formed, and the jockey club became the national relicensing agent of all jockeys. Well, guess who wasn't relicensed? Hmm. Black jockeys weren't. So by 1900, they were basically out the business. And what I'm saying is that don't trip on the fact that, you know, the NBA is 70% black and the NFL 60% black, because this can change immediately. And if you look at quote unquote globalization, it's already beginning to happen in the NBA.
My guest on WNYC is William Roden, New York Times sports columnist. His new book is called $40 Million Slaves, The Rise, Fall, and Redemption of the Black Athlete. And we can take your phone calls for William Roden. Are you a black athlete? Do you have any questions about the history of black athletes in America? What do you think of the concept of the title of this book, $40 Million Slaves? Call us at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or email brianlehrershow@wnyc.org. Talk more about the NBA. They're recruiting outside of America to consciously try to reduce the percentage of blacks in the league, you think?
Well, when you say I'm still kind of, you know, I can't believe and that's why this thing works. I couldn't believe that somebody would do it consciously, but I just think that what part of the effect of globalization in general and specific to the NBA is that you're beginning to now bring in more talent. So maybe instead of that 15th guy on the bench being consistently African American, well, maybe the 15th and the 14th guy are from somewhere else. Could be from China, could be from Korea. And at one level, you say, well, Bill, what's wrong with that? You know, diversity as well. And the problem with diversity, if you're an African-American, and I'm talking about what I see in newsrooms, including mine at the New York Times, you know, they say diversity, but we're kind of being diversified out of existence because, well, you know, we're not so much just the black, but we want to get, you know, racial, we want to get ethnic diversity, we want to get financial diversity, we want people from the East, the, you know. So I could walk into a press box today and see, like, maybe two black people. But they'll tell me that what I'm looking at, well, but yeah, but it's diverse because, look, we've got some women over here and we've got some people from the South over here. And so globalization is good in one level. But if you look in terms of African-American athletes in this NBA, if they help build, the clock is kind of ticking. And that, you know,
it even goes to a fundamental question about affirmative action. This is outside the realm of sports necessarily, but do you think there's too much affirmative action outreach to different kinds of people because the fundamental evil in American history that needs to be corrected was slavery?
So, you see, you know, bro, that's not only is it a great point, that's the fundamental point. But I think that what I see now, particularly in a younger group of people, like people in their 40s, you know, is that that's no longer relevant. That's that kind of basic issue. So, you know what? It's too deep, too heavy. Let's move on. You know, and uh-huh. Kind of in the book, I'm kind of arguing part of what I'm saying is that, OK, we've got enough power in the sports to move on. We've got enough power to, if we work as a unit to buy, to buy banks, to buy hospitals, to do things. In other words, we cannot continue. When the Knicks are playing the Boston Celtics, you know, I'm the coach of the Knicks. It's inconceivable for me to go into the Boston Celtics locker room and beg for mercy and say, listen, Don't press me. Just you know, that's what I want to make sure is that the Knicks, you know, are together. That our team is together. So, you know, when we talk about affirmative action, things like that, those are things we've got to fight. But in sports, there is enough power now. There's enough money. There's enough wealth that if used as a team, as a cohesive, can really begin to wage a serious fight.
Ben in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with William Roden. Hi, Ben.
Hey, how you doing?
Good morning.
Hey, how you doing? Oh, you know what? You said something at the end of the last, almost the last segment, where you said about the globalization of the NBA taking place already. And it's almost like gentrification in a way, because I used to live in Turkey. I played a little ball overseas for a Turkish team. And when there's a player now in the NBA, Turkoglu,
mm-hmm, right.
He was in high school then. And literally, NBA action, which is the only way Turks were able to get NBA games, you know, for the most part, was only on 30 minutes a day. I mean, 30 minutes as, like, one day a week, as a matter of fact. As soon as he hit the league, immediately they got three-day coverage, and it moved up to almost an hour. And you can see it. That's what these owners care about. They only care about the business side of it, and that's why they have to have a player from Italy. Because when their games are televised in Italy, if there's one Italian player, the entire country will watch it for that one mm-hmm. player. Same thing with a Yugoslav or anything like that.
So how do you think that relates to U.S. and African-American player fortunes in this country? Any thought, Ben?
Well, that also because of the fact that it's just like this. I've never once seen anybody complain about the way Steve Nash dressed. You know, Steve Nash is gone, multi-million. Never once has there been a white player in the league who there was a complaint or any issue as to his style.
For being flamboyant or whatever. Bill Roden, we have to break in 20 seconds. What do you say to Ben?
Yeah, well, basically, he's kind of in the right church. You know, the question is, analysis is one thing, but the question is, then what do you do? I mean, you could read the play, but what do you do when you see the play coming? And I think that
we'll have to save that mystery for after the break and find out what we do in Act Two of this play, $40 Million Slaves, the new book by New York Times sports columnist William Roden. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and the latest Brian Lehrer Show reading project is now up on our website. It's an excerpt from the new book by Linda Hirschman called Get to Work, A Manifesto for Women of the World. And yes, it is about mothers and working outside the home. We will have Linda Hirschman on the show on Wednesday to discuss it. You may remember she set off a new skirmish in the mommy wars, as they call them, with her article in the American Prospect last winter, calling for women to stay out of the house and find jobs if they want respect and equality. This is the book version, but is this just retrofeminism or a new rallying cry for today's realities? Read the excerpt from Linda Hirschman's book, Get to Work, A Manifesto for Women of the World. It's at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. We'll have her on the show on Wednesday. With me right now, William Roden, New York Times sports columnist. His new book, $40 Million Slaves, The Rise, Fall, and Redemption of the Black Athletes. Our phones are full. Our email box is open, brianlehrershow@wnyc.org. You were going to get to Act Two.
Act Two.
Which is where we go from here.
Where do we go from here? I mean, that's always the key issue in these things. But what do? You read the play, and somebody once told me, a football player once told me a long time ago, he said, you know, the difference between a rookie and a veteran is when you're a rookie, you read film and all that during the week, and you see these are the keys. But in the game, you see it coming, and a rookie doesn't believe what he's seeing. And a veteran does. So just like the other caller was saying, this is really coming. But I think that players in the NBA, you really have to wake up and you really have to understand that the clock is ticking. This isn't going to go on forever. You guys are going to be 67% of the league making, you know, 20 million. It's not going to go on forever.
Because of globalization.
Because of globalization and let's just keep it at that. Because at least because of globalization.
Well, you know, NBA Commissioner David Stern has an op-ed today talking about a new training system for young NBA players modeled on the European approach instead of relying on sneaker company teams. Are you familiar with that? And is that part of this concept of the conveyor belt that you talk of in your book?
Well, I think that what he's saying, I mean, and David has been a big proponent of, you know, of globalization and that and also of behavior and, you know, and he's done a magnificent job in taking a league that's, you know, 80% black and making people kind of not see it, you know, and not see the color. But, yeah, the whole conveyor belt thing, yeah, I mean, and one of that's a great idea of taking some of the power away from the sneaker companies because, you know, the conveyor belt that you refer to is a system by which athletes go from bitty basketball to the NBA.
Uh-huh.
But what really happens on the conveyor belt is more damaging. It's sort of the kind of brainwashing that goes along on each level of the conveyor belt where people, a lot of young kids understand that the people who got the power are white people, either as coaches, as the people who are going to sell me the house, the people who are going to give me money over or under the table in college. And you learn that if I just don't rock the boat, if I just kind of just keep my mouth shut, run through the wall, everything will be okay.
And there are some black coaches. There are more black coaches, managers. There are a few black owners. But you're saying it's still basically such a white world that this is what the coming black athlete has to deal with.
I mean, you kind of have, you know, you have seven black coaches. But, I mean, if you look at the power structure, if you go into any NBA office, if you go into the commissioner's office and you kind of look around, you look at the NFL office, you go to marketing firms, you vertically and laterally,
overwhelmingly,
to understand who controls this.
Michael in Forest Hills, you're on WNYC with William Roden.
Mr. Roden, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Oh, not too bad. Well, I want to ask you a question, and it's always a little uncomfortable discussing race. It's you know, it's a pretty fraught topic, and also we're talking about sports, which is you know, you like to relax with. But so I have a question for you regarding, you know, the black attitude towards sports. And what I guess I'm wondering is that, you know, you have the stereotype of the Jewish mother. They all want their kids to become doctors or lawyers. And, you know, there's a certain amount of truth to it. But I sometimes get the feeling that in the black community, there's often a feeling that, listen, the way that you make money is you become a basketball player. But the truth is very few, you know, people will actually make the millions and millions of dollars that they do, and maybe for the community, the black community in general, that they'd be better off if they...
A self-defeating hope if it's that widespread.
Yeah.
What do you think
about
that?
I think the black community now is so fragmented because of integration and, we're in so many things. But I'll go with you on that if we just talk about the black community. Yeah, I mean, I think that sports historically, from Jack Johnson, the pride we got from Jack Johnson beating, Jim Jeffries and the Great White Hope, Joe Louis, fighting for, Jackie. It's been very important. And to have your child be a professional athlete is a big deal. And that's a big deal for a lot of people. I think it's become a bigger deal for people just to get that college scholarship. And I think people do know that it's a shot in the dark. But also, I got to tell you, I played my first football game in Yankee Stadium in 1968. And as I walked off the field, if you would have asked me, tell me that I was going to be a sports writer, columns for the New York Times, the odds of that were probably worse than me being a professional athlete. And so you have to look around. We need more doctors in the black community. We need more architects and all that. But unfortunately, if you just look at the realities of our society, and I'm not talking about the 2% of the people who are making have good jobs, but just the larger number of people who find themselves further and further out on the periphery, unfortunately, if you're going to get that shot, that one shot, it's going to be through athletics or football or something like that. What I want to do...
Because of the nature of other opportunities that aren't there, you're saying.
Yeah, because, you look at a lot of white kids, and you say, well, why don't we have white cornerbacks? There comes to be a point when they just have a lot of options. This has been fun, but my father, he's got his own business. It could just be the automobile...
Right. Sure. Well, I'll use myself as an example. My 8-year-old wants to be a Major League Baseball player. And he would practice every day and he would do nothing but, go to baseball school if it was up to him. And I tell him, look, have fun with baseball. Right. And maybe there's a 1 in a billion chance that you actually wind up a baseball player. But you have to prepare yourself for other things because the odds are so small.
Odds are small. But, kids don't. I mean, right now you're 8-year-old and the way it is.
But is that a different message than you think, percentage-wise, fewer black parents are giving their kids that message that I'm giving mine?
I think that people now, because I think people are saying it now, whether you believe it in your heart. Because remember, until this rule passed in the NBA, you could look, if your kid was 8, you could say, wow, by the time he's 17, he could kind of be, first of all, he might get a great scholarship to school. I mean, and remember, a scholarship, we're talking about kids going to University of Michigan. I mean, it's a lot of money. And it becomes financial. Wow, if my daughter could just, play a little ball, or if my son,
Right.
So
when there are a lack of options out there, even if it's just a way to get into college, never mind the pros.
And if you're talking about maybe Ken Chenault's son, who's American Express, I think Ken may still say, go ahead and do it. We're going to support you, but there are some other options if you fall.
$40 Million Slaves, The Rise, Fall, and Redemption of the Black Athlete, the title of a new book by New York Times sports columnist William Roden, who's my guest on WNYC 93.9 and AM 820. Our phone number, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or email brianlehrershow@WNYC.org. And Robert on Long Island, you're on WNYC. Hello, Robert.
Hi, good morning. Good morning, Mr. Roden.
Hey, how you doing, Robert?
I told the screen I was going to ask one question, but as I was listening, my thoughts have drifted to another sense, and that is... this is the great point, I think, of this conversation, and that's the wider structure of our society is more really the topic of your conversation than sports, because sports is simply nothing more or less than a corporate entity inside of a capitalist structure that we live in. I mean, are white ball players, are white athletes part of that slave group? Well, you can make the case that they're not because they have wider opportunity, but... The black athletes certainly do a lot better than the typical wage earner inside of a corporation out in the wider society. And they do much better than that.
But for how long? I mean, we're talking about a very short... Well, go ahead. Let me hear your question before I jump in.
The point is that the more that this fascinating discussion gets underway, it's really not about sports at all. It's about globalization or the capitalist structure. I mean, and then you've got this enormously complex topic of race on top of it. But to single out sports and to put a label slave on it, I think it's to miss the point of a much wider point. I think it's kind of outmoded.
Well, I wish it were outmoded. I mean, if you're going to talk about literal slavery, of course, but if you're going to talk about the extent to which, I mean, you brought up something, which radio, how free are any of us, really? But, you know, I operate in the sports realm, and I used to be a jazz critic at the Baltimore Sun, and I raised some of the same issues in jazz, and that here you have these tremendous performers, these tremendous innovators, and their frustration is not being able to control their innovation, their product. They played, they made a record date, and that was kind of it, but they didn't control the record companies, they didn't control distribution. They had a consciousness, but they didn't have any real power. Now I'm in an industry where you've got people who've got now a lot of power to control things, but they don't necessarily have the consciousness. And, I mean, you bring up some tremendous points that I think are a little broader. They're too broad to deal with right now in terms of sports in a corporate structure. What I'm trying to understand right now is that in journalism, Richard Lapchick just wrote a report, a study about the African-American presence in journalism, which is in sports journalism, which is nil. It's like it's gotten worse. And the one area where black people are really represented in a very powerful level in our industry is on the field and on the court. How do you translate that into some type of broader power? You know, if Michael Jordan goes through a newsroom or a production company and he just makes an offhanded comment, aren't there any black people know how to work cameras here? Hmm. You know, or you go through a marketing company as he did once and he noticed there were no black secretaries. He made a phone call, you know, and next week there was a black secretary. So I'm kind of you're talking about, I'm just talking about something very basic and rudimentary in achieving power in this society.
So to go to the caller's point or take it another step, does Robert Johnson, owner of the Hornets, own the team any differently than a white owner?
That gets to the point. I would hope so. I hope that all this stuff would make a difference. I mean, I hope that the whole point of going through this journey of segregation, of the plantation, so that when you get to a point of power and in control, you know, you understand what needs to be done. You understand the concept of fair play. You understand what the community needs. Unfortunately, as Bob Johnson was saying, I'm a capitalist first, you know, and why a lot of people were disappointed with Bob, with BET, who was saying, you know, that's our only voice. And he said, yeah, but when it came time to sell, I'm selling to the highest bidder. So your question is, the answer to your question is a hopeful, I hope so. I hope it makes a difference.
But you haven't seen it yet.
I haven't seen it yet, and the jury is still out.
Conte in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with William Roden.
Hi, I think I'm getting tired of hearing people always seeing conspiracies everywhere. We have to be honest sometimes and admit that blacks have been, Michael Jordan was able to purchase the team, and you have players coming from even Africa like Hakeem Olajuwon. So it maybe there's the scale of the players in America is diminishing because you have someone like Shaquille O'Neal with all the money he's making, who cannot even make free throws. So
he can't make what?
Basketball.
Free throws.
He cannot make three throws.
Yeah, well, Michael Jordan doesn't own a team, by the way. He owns a fraction of a team. And by the way, I'm glad you mentioned Michael Jordan. I'm glad you mentioned that because this makes part of it kind of – Michael Jordan went back to the Washington Wizards because Abe Pollin, there was sort of the idea of a promise that he would be a partner in Abe Pollin's team. So Michael Jordan went back to the Wizards. You can't play and own. And he made that franchise very viable. They had built a new a stadium right in the heart of D.C. And it was more people came. You know, as soon as Michael Jordan quit and he retired, now he wanted to come back to be the take up his partnership. Abe Pollin fired him. He said, I don't want to be your partner. You know, he essentially kind of took him in the yard and shot him. And it was a lesson. Here's one of the great, as you say.
Did that have to do with race, in your opinion?
I think everything has to do with race. I mean, but no, Abe will tell you, listen, I'm a member in the NAACP, some of my best friends, I do some great things for the black community. That would not have happened to a white athlete of that stature. It hasn't happened yet. Somebody like Larry Bird, who wanted to be a partner. And now they want to be I'm talking about who was the greatest player of the century.
But here's Michael Jordan, who you criticize, as others have before you, for not having enough of a public social consciousness, who kind of, to so many people, kind of transcends race, you know, as some white people might say, though you wouldn't like it. I don't even think of him as black.
Right.
I mean, what would the percentage be in dismissing Michael Jordan because he's black?
Well, he got blindsided. Let's turn it around. I think that this blindsided Michael Jordan because I think that he thought that he transcended race. See, and that's what happens to a lot of these when you make this kind of money and you're white handlers and you're white, listen, you're beyond race. We're colorblind and all that, but you never are. You never are. And I'm sure Michael Jordan was probably one of the most surprised people in the world when that rug was pulled out of him because he said, wait a minute, I got money. I'm Michael Jordan. I go, you can't do this to me. You know, and it happened. And you said, well, would this happen to anybody else? We're talking about the NBA, where this is one of the most revered figures in a league that's 80% black. And it's like they would do on the plantation. They take the most powerful bad guy and whip him and break him down as a lesson that nobody is bigger than this game.
Do you think black athletes have more responsibility? Because athletics was the only place where they were allowed to excel for so long. Responsibility to kind of give back, whatever that means.
I think we all do. I think we all do because of our entry into the country. I mean, every ethnic group has had its cross to bear in making this country great. Our cross was that we were the only ethnic group that was brought here against our will, and that has a series of consequences. And unfortunately, because of that, there's always a battle to fight. Now, do you have the option? And that's why I say that we confront a series of promised lands. You know, there was the Emancipation Proclamation. That was the first promised land. Then there was Jim Crow. But we're sort of on this existential errand in that there's just when you think there's one promised land has been achieved, then you realize, you know what, there's another one. But it's a natural human thing to say, you know what, I'm tired. This is my $2 million home. I've been able to buy my mother a home. Listen, Roden, I'm stopping here. Now, you go on if you want. But to answer your question, yes, I think that there is obligation. Whether you choose to deal with it or not is your personal choice.
We're going to run out of time here in about 2 minutes, but your subtitle is Rise, Fall, and Redemption of the Black Athlete. What's the redemption?
No, that's hopeful. The redemption is I kind of saw it a little bit in Katrina. Where I drove down to Mississippi just kind of on my own because like everybody I was so deficit. And there were some NBA players who were there. And a lot of those guys were from the South, from Mississippi. And I think for the first time, a lot realized, golly, that could have easily been me. Had I not grown to be 6'8 or something like that, this could have been my family that was washed out with no safety net. So I think that a lot of them, for the first time, said, wow, there's an economic reality here that I could be a part of. So I think the hopeful part of the redemption is that there's going to be a coming together as a team, realizing that each of us are doing some good things individually, but the magnitude of the problems facing our community are much larger than any one person's foundation. We've got to work as a team, work more of as a unit.
Your next book, I gather, is going to be on the NFL quarterback Warren Moon, correct?
Well, actually, I'm doing a book. It's going to be an oral history of black quarterbacks, in which Warren Moon is, you know, James Harris, Doug Williams, they're part of it, which is equally fascinating.
To make what overarching point in our last 15 seconds?
It's just more of an oral history of where Michael Vick is now. Those kind of doors that were open. It started with a group of people playing a position that they didn't say blacks couldn't play.
We could go on with this for hours. You will have to come back. William Roden, New York Times sports columnist. His new book is $40 Million Slaves, The Rise, Fall, and Redemption of the Black Athlete, published by Crown. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Thanks for listening to The Brian Lehrer Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.